Because UCL is such a biomedically focused university, so, so much of its research is in that area, the other areas of research that UCL does can be overlooked. And social enterprise means that you can access the whole range of research that's going on at UCL and all of the activities. And it means that you can then reach out to those groups where maybe you wouldn't have seen anything in common.
Social enterprise spin-offs is just one of the many aspects that make UCL Business, the tech transfer office for University College London, unique. There is also the UCL Technology Fund and Apollo Therapeutics, for example. Today, I talk to Anne Lane, the CEO of UCL Business, about this and more, including an inspiring story about how her team worked with Mercedes to help COVID patients in ICUs. To start with, maybe you can give us a bit of an overview of what UCL Business does. If you have any headline figures that you want to share, I always quite like hearing those as well.
Yes, no, of course. I think probably the best thing to do is to start with talking about UCL first, because then that puts UCLB in context. I think UCL is one of the largest universities in the world. It's got 41,500 students from about 150 countries and more than 12,500 staff. So it's very big. It is London's global university and it has that reach. And I think that's demonstrated by the fact that its students come from such a wide number of countries. It's also got a very radical approach. And it was one of the first universities in England to have an open university press. And it's a world leading university. So it's amongst the top 10 globally and amongst the top four in the UK. And it's research intensive. But it has a wide range, so from arts and humanities, right through historical and social sciences to computer science and engineering. So that's the basis that UCLB has to work on, which is great because it gives us a lot of reach and a lot of deal flow. It has a strong innovation enterprise culture as well, which as a commercialization office really helps. So UCLB is a wholly owned subsidiary of UCL. And I think most institutions across the world have different ways of commercializing their research. And this is the way that works best for UCL. We are what I would call a fully integrated commercialization company. And by that, I mean that we have business managers who are inward and outward facing. They liaise with our researchers at UCL as well as work with our commercialization partners. But to back those business managers up, we have project managers who help with our translational projects and also with our investment projects. We have a legal team, which consists of corporate intellectual property and patent lawyers. We have a strong finance team and also an operations team. So we offer the whole service, really. And there are about 52 employees within the company. And over the last year, we've been very active. So we've had around 700 license deals. And almost 2,000 COVID-19 response licenses, which is great, but it means we're very busy. We have 63 new patents, and that probably comes from around 80 to 90 new IDFs a year, which can sound quite low for a university the size of UCL, but actually we're quite rigorous in what we class as an invention disclosure. We do a little bit of research before it's counted as a full invention disclosure. We had around 37.5 million income last year from our IP, and we returned 19 million of that to stakeholders. So we're quite a large organization and we've been very successful, but that's based on more than 20 years of doing technology transfer and commercialization. So we've been going a long time, and I think that makes a difference. That, as well as having such a big university and such a world-leading university as UCL behind you, really puts us into that position. I think the fact that we've got investment funds helps. And I think the fact that we have such a global reach really shows in our spin-out companies. So we've had four IPOs over the last 3 years on NASDAQ. They've all been in cell and gene therapy, which demonstrates one of UCL's strengths. And I think that shows really how successful what we've done is, but really based on the strength of UCL's research.
You've already mentioned the pandemic, so I feel like we should get that one out of the way.
Yeah, we can go straight to that. Actually, one point that I didn't mention, the latest Hebke results, actually UCL spin-outs raised the most in external investments. So it's almost 600 million. So that was something that we're incredibly proud of, as well as our IPOs. Didn't want to forget mentioning that. But yeah, on the pandemic.
How has it like specifically affected your work? And do you think there's any changes that or hope that are going to become permanent?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think in terms of how much it's affected our work, not very much, because we moved to remote working back in March when the government restrictions came in. That seemed to happen almost seamlessly. I'm sure our IT manager might have a different story, but from everyone else that I've spoken to, we seem to make that transition very well. And if anything, our work has just become more frantic. We've been very, very busy. And not just in COVID-related projects either, but our general workload has gone up and we've had more projects and more potential projects come through to us from the university. I think the fact that we have such a strong innovation culture at UCL helped with one of the big projects that we worked on, which was those COVID response licenses that I mentioned. That was based on a breathing device. So at UCL, it's called the UCL Ventura device. It's a continuous positive airway pressure breathing device, and it helps prevent people having to go into the ICU and onto ventilators. And I think that demonstrates something that I actually think universities are very good at doing anyway, but I think it's something you can always improve, where lots of diverse groups got together and worked as a really strong team to bring something to the benefit of society very, very quickly. And in this case, it was patients infected with the COVID virus who become seriously ill. And we used a platform that we developed at UCLB, which was for what we call express licensing. So for things like software, which aren't high value licenses, but actually can be quite lucrative to the university. And also it means that you can get those licenses quickly out of the university where they can make a real impact. And so when the office closed down in March, what happened was that our Institute of Healthcare Engineering worked with UCLH and the clinicians there who, as you probably know, work very closely with the university and have joint contracts. And they found that they had a problem with trying to stop people going onto ventilators and that they needed more devices. I think because COVID had shut down so many activities, that meant that there was almost a perfect storm. I don't know if that's quite the right analogy, but where you had a company like Mercedes that would have been focused on Formula One, but actually, you know, had its operations really not doing very much. You had a really strong medical need, and all of those groups came together and over the Easter holiday managed to get a device into the NHS within a very short space of time. And it's now right across the UK, as well as being accessible globally, so that we made the design rights for that device available right across the world. And that's where the 2,000 licenses have come from. Those are countries that have accessed those design rights and are now making their own device for their own population. And I think that's what makes the job so exciting. That was really great. What would be great to see is if that speed and interaction can carry on. But obviously, you've got to lay that on the fact that companies like Mercedes will be going back to Formula One. They're not going to be there to put their facilities at our disposal. But I think that interaction with government, with the regulatory agencies, with the clinicians, with patients as well, because they've got to put some trust in these devices too, and with our own researchers, and also with UCL being able to be agile and flexible, made a huge difference. And that's something that would be really good to continue doing.
I think that idea of speed is one that I've heard from a few people. I know I had Oren Hoskowitz from Columbia on the podcast. He said, you know, if you delay it by 6 months, that's potentially thousands of people that have died, even if the treatment is basically, well, not ready to go because it's still clinical trials and everything. But the speed at which at least we're tackling COVID is quite phenomenal.
I think so. And it's not just UCL. You know, I mean, there's other universities. Obviously, there's Oxford with the vaccine and Cambridge. But there are lots of other universities that have worked really, really quickly and put their resources at the disposal of the people who need it most. You know, we have strong social enterprise culture at UCL as well, and that helped set up an antiviral company for COVID. So there's a number of ways that I think the pandemic has really brought out the best in all of those different groups. We've really learned a lot from it, and I hope we can carry forward that when we do get back to some sort of normality.
Fingers crossed. Moving on to slightly happier news. You've been with UCL for about 2 decades, I think. It makes you sound very old. But, you really don't look it. So
thank you.
But you joined when it was still UCL Ventures, and now obviously it's UCL Business. How did you get into tech transfer? And what's made you stick around broadly and with UCL specifically?
I think that's a long story, but I've got a long history with UCL. I did my PhD there back in the 90s, and I did a postdoctoral fellowship there as well. And then I moved to North America to do more postdoctoral research. I moved to Boston. And then I moved up to Montreal in Canada, where they were trying to establish a strong biotech community and cluster in Quebec. And it was the right time to do that. And I also did an MBA while I was there. So it was a bit of a baptism by fire, but that really thrust me into the commercial side of research very, very quickly. Then I saw the job advertised at UCL Ventures, and obviously because it was UCL that attracted me, because I had a long relationship with UCL and was very happy there. And so I applied for the job and got the job. Really, why I've been there so long is I think it's one of the best jobs you could do. It's exciting. You're working with some of the best minds in the world at the university. I realized as well, being a scientist, that actually there were other people who were much better at it than I was. So I liked being involved with the science, and this was a job that meant I could carry on being involved with the science, really help to make the maximum impact, but without doing the science myself, because there are other people who were much better at it than I was. But I think, UCL is a great place to work. It's very flexible. The fact that we have been able to do what we've done as a company, I think, is testament to the fact that it's so flexible. It has a great innovation culture. And it has a very wide-ranging approach. I think the fact that we look at social sciences as social enterprise as well does make a difference, because it means that we're not just focused on a financial return. I think that's really important, especially when you're working at the university, because that's not what people are there for. They're there to make a difference. And so that's what we're there for too. And that's why I've carried on being at UCL for as long as I have. It's a great university. And, I think it's one of the best jobs you could do, really. Always exciting, always something new every day. And you get a reward, you see the benefits of what you're doing, which I think you can't say that about every job. So I have been there for a long time. I've been there in a number of different roles, but I think it's given me a great insight into how UCL works and then what we can do to make it better, really.
Are there any key points that you've learned in your career that you wish you would have known coming into this, or that you would want people who are starting out to know?
I think be flexible. That seems to be my mantra at the moment. Be flexible and take the opportunities as you see them. Sometimes you don't think things are really going to get you very far, but they do. So I think trying new things out, not being afraid to take some risks has really helped me, because I can remember distinctly when I went from being a bench scientist to suddenly moving away from that world, I really did not think there was a world outside of research science. And actually, there is. And there's lots of ways you can still contribute and make a difference. Things are not black and white. So working in research generally, I think, is a very ambiguous environment to work in. Working in tech transfer and commercialization takes that ambiguity to a whole new level. And I think you have to look for, key thing is to listen to what the researchers are telling you and what your academics are telling you, because they're the ones who really know more than you'll ever know about what they're doing. And I think very often they have a lot of commercial leads as well. And I think sometimes that can get overlooked, that very often it's the academics who, with their collaborators, find those commercial leads that can make all the difference. And you need their support. Really, you're never going to be able to commercialize any research without the researcher, the inventor, being on board, because they're the ones who really make the difference. I think the other thing I would say is, I don't think you need a PhD to do this job. I know that used to be almost an essential requirement if you wanted to get into technology transfer or commercialization. But actually, I don't think you do need a PhD. I think you can come from any background, really, to do what we do. Having the science or having some knowledge of the type of research that's being done can really help. But I don't think having a PhD is a prerequisite. And I think that has in the past put a lot of people off, but I don't really think it should.
That's interesting, because that's, I know I mentioned Oren earlier, but he's a man with an English major, and then he tacked an MBA on, and now he's leading one of the most successful TTOs in the US, and it's not something that...
Well, absolutely. I know Oren well, and I know Oren because we work on the 10U together, which is an organization where we try and share best practice. Yeah, and he's got a great perspective on things. And I think just goes to show you don't need a science PhD to work in university commercialization.
Maybe there's hope for us humanities people yet.
There you are, you see. Well, and actually some of the things I expect we'll touch upon have come from, you know, non-science areas of research and from completely unexpected angles.
I found that quite interesting, actually, the whole social enterprises. It's not something that a lot of universities seem to do. I know Oxford does it. They've got Mark Mann. I think they just did their 10th today as we're recording this as well. So it's quite interesting that UCL is big on that idea as well.
Yeah. I mean, I it's something I've always been interested in. And I think because UCL is such a biomedically focused university, so much of its research is in that area, that the other areas of research that UCL does can be overlooked. And social enterprise means, and doing community interest companies, I think mean that you can access the whole range of research that's going on at UCL and all of the activities. And it means that you can then reach out to those groups where maybe you wouldn't have seen anything in common before. So social enterprise has really, really helped us to do that. And we've set up our own proof of concept social enterprise investment fund within UCLB, Innovation and Enterprise, which is the department within the university of which we're a part, has a POC fund as well. So we can use small investments, amounts of money to bring on social ventures. And generally speaking, they don't need huge amounts of investment to start with. A really good example of that, if I can give you one, of which came from the Slade School of Fine Art. And you wouldn't really think fine art was something that was going to come up with a big commercial potential. But actually, the fine art degrees, I think, are one of the most applied degrees you can have, because they teach at UCL, certainly, and I'm sure they do this at other fine art schools through the world, they teach you how to deal with galleries and how to display your art. So they're already looking at how you make an impact from what you're doing, which is something that I think people are quite surprised to learn about. So we started off by helping to fund the Slade Print Fair. So we used our POC fund to help them get that established. And that's great, because the money they make from those print fairs goes back into scholarships, funding professorial chairs, helping disadvantaged students have access to somewhere like the Slade. Leading on from that, one of the artists there, Anya McCausland, came up with a new paint range, which is actually based on the waste products from coal mining.
Wow.
So it ticked so many boxes, and it's one of the things I'm most proud of, really, that UCLB and UCL has done was to set up, it's called the Turning Landscape Kit, and it's a social enterprise. But the beautiful colour range of paints and their emulsions for the home, as well as tubes of paint for artists. And it's using something that really caused problems environmentally to make something positive. So that is just one of the best things, I think, just really. And it's a great demonstration, I think, of where social enterprise, commercialization, and somewhere like the Slade can really move together to make a big difference.
Yeah, that is amazing.
That's one of the ones that I'm most proud of, because I know you'd ask me what one of my favorite spin outs was.
Yes, I was gonna, my favorite question, my favorite spin outs. I mean, if you if that is it, that's fine, we can skip the question. But if you have any others,
I'm proud of all of our spin outs, because they've all done wonderful things. That one is one that really stands out in my mind. I'm gonna be a bit naughty and say there is another one that really stands out.
You can have
two favourite children. And it's called Endomag. And the reason that I mentioned that company is that really shows the cross-disciplinarity of things that go on at UCL. So that started off in materials science and in engineering, and they had a magnetic tracer that they were using to help focus breast cancer surgery, so that you reduce the amount of surgery that's needed. You can target the surgery much more effectively. And I think that's a really effective way of bringing those two disciplines together. So that's why that company stands out. It's doing very well. It's working in the US. So it's really having an impact, and it's really addressing an unmet patient need too. And it's commercial benefit. So it eventually it will return money back to us and back to the university.
That's amazing. That's two very worthy contenders, I think, for
Yeah. I could go on. I could talk about more.
I am sure.
I don't think we've got time for that.
Something slightly different. You're a woman in a leadership position in tech transfer. Tech transfer generally, I think, seems to be doing quite well at women reaching the top in this career. How does UCL fare when it comes to engagement from women faculty and perhaps other minorities, if that's something that you track?
We don't actively track it. I think UCL does well. And we have a number of women CEOs of our companies and women faculty who've come to us. And in fact, the UCL Ventura that I talked about, the breathing device, that is a female professor in the Institute of Healthcare Engineering. So I don't think that's really an issue for us in terms of what comes through commercialization. I think UCLB itself has an extremely diverse staff. So that's not just in terms of ethnic background, but also in sex and sexual orientation. We've always recruited on the basis of talent, and I certainly don't think that talent's restricted to any one group. So I think you just have to look at our website and you can see that there's a range of people from a range of different backgrounds. So I'm proud of how diverse UCLB is, and I'm proud of the number of women, certainly, and also faculty from other ethnic backgrounds who work with us. I don't think that certainly as a commercialization company that we put any barriers up. And I think that's borne out by looking at what we've managed to do and the staff that we currently have.
That's wonderful.
I think there's always room for improvement. You know, it is still difficult. You look at Fortune 500 boards, they're still not fantastic at the number of women who are on them. And you look at some websites for a lot of investment companies and other groups. And again, you know, it's not as diverse as it probably could be.
Yeah.
And as I said, talent's not restricted to any one group. It's making sure that everyone gets the same chance, I think.
Yeah. It's something that I've always found interesting, because when I've spoken to investors as well, where they've mentioned that they want the diversity on their team, because if they have someone with an ethnic minority background, they will have an entire network of people that the white man will just not be aware of, that there's connections and opportunities for investments that just they would not have seen.
I think that's right. And I think it's that everyone feels comfortable interacting with whoever it is they have to interact with. And if you've got role models, and role models are a very important thing, if you've got role models, then you can see that you can do that too. So, you know, I had some fabulous female role models when I was growing up. I mean, I actually went to a convent school, which is not where you would necessarily see, but honestly, they were very forward thinking in terms of a religious group, very liberal, very forward thinking. And I think it's made a big difference. And I think having strong role models really does make a difference.
I think you are probably serving as a strong role model to a lot of women out there as well.
You. So I hope so.
Something slightly different. You talked about POC funding as well, but you've also got the UCL Technology Fund, obviously, on its way to raising £100 million at the moment. How important is it to have a massive resource like that on your doorstep?
I think it's incredibly important. We could not have done many of the things that we've done without having access to those funds. I shouldn't really underestimate the translational funding that was involved prior to that. So the Wellcome Trust and the MRC, when they put in more translational funding, that made a big difference too. And I think that helped to enable us to raise these funds. You know, you can look at what they've invested in. So over the last year, just in the last year, they've invested around 8 million. And I think since they were started in 2016, and I'm saying they, I'm talking about the UCL Technology Fund and the Apollo collaboration as well. I'll give you a little bit more information on that. But between them, they've invested more than £57 million since 2016. And that has made a big difference to us. With UTF, that actually it's a unique model because UCLB co-manages the fund with UTF. I should say quickly that we don't do any regulated activities because UCLB is not regulated, but UTF is. So What UCLB does is the non-regulated activities, which is mostly project origination. But the fund managers are embedded in UCLB when we're actually physically in the office. They spend part of their time in our office and part of their time back at the Albion Capital offices. And just this year, we started a secondment fund where one of our BMs does a year's placement with Albion so that they're seconded into Albion, so that they get that and then they come back to UCLB. That's one of the conditions of doing the secondment, is that you come back and you bring that experience back with you. That really, really helps and makes that fund unique. UCL itself is invested in the fund, so it's very closely aligned with the university, and the university has an interest in that. And we also share the fees and we share the carry of that fund. So it's incredibly important for us. I can't really emphasize how important it is. That Apollo collaboration works well with the fund too. So the two actually have worked very well together, both established in the same year. And the Apollo collaboration is something I'd like to talk about, because that is, I don't know how much you know about it, but it's...
I haven't followed it much since its launch in 2016, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it was interesting because it was, I think the thinking behind it was that universities spend a lot of time researching and then developing projects to try and license to Big Pharma. And very often what happens is Big Pharma then redoes the work because it's not done how they would do it. And that's not a very capital efficient way of bringing on new projects. And so the Apollo collaboration was founded originally with three universities, Cambridge, Imperial and UCL, and three Big Pharma, so AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson and GSK. And they all put money in. Fund total was £40 million. And that was to invest in projects that originally, I think the intention was that they would be licensed to those Big Pharma. And if they weren't licensed to those Big Pharma, the universities introducing them to the collaboration could then license out to other companies. The money that came back in went into the Apollo collaboration. And that really has made a difference as well, because it has given both sides, so the universities and, I shouldn't really say sides, but both the different groups, insights into the priorities and how the others work. That's been great. And I think it's helped, particularly for researchers who don't necessarily want to go into a spin out. They want to see their work have an impact. They're interested in commercialization, but they want to carry on with their academic careers. And this allows them to do that because the Apollo collaboration will take those projects on, invest money in developing them further and get them to a point where you've got big value inflection point and it builds that value for everyone. That has been very helpful. And then some of the projects that Apollo has invested in have then been taken on by UTF for them to invest further. It's been a synergistic relationship. It's worked very well.
That's very interesting. I hadn't realized, we tend to mostly focus on spin outs, so the licensing deals is not something that I look at specifically. So I hadn't really realized the partnership that's between Apollo and UTF as well. That's very interesting.
I think as well, and something I didn't probably make clear about UTF is that it invests in setting up spin-out companies, but it also invests in projects which will then go on to be licensed. That's quite different to the normal investment fund that you might have.
Yeah.
That, I think, was why it took so long for us to get that established in the first place, because we were working on trying to establish the fund for about 10 years because we were putting those two things together. And it's quite hard for a traditional investor to understand really how those two things are going to work. But it has definitely worked. We've had four exits from the first fund in the first 3 years. So hopefully it will carry on with the second fund.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, as you said, it's a phenomenal success rate so far. If you think a fund has a 10-year lifespan and you get really big exits as well, it was not just a couple of million here and there. It's, you know, listing on NASDAQ, as you said, they're very notable exits.
Yeah, we're very pleased with how the fund has developed.
How do you see the UK ecosystem overall today? Is there anything missing, or is there anything that could be done better?
The pandemic has shown how innovative the UK ecosystem is and how world-class the research is from the UK. What could be done better? I think that's really why we set Apollo and UTF up, is because there, I think, has been an overemphasis on setting up spin-outs and companies when that's not always the best way, you know, to develop a technology. There are requirements that you need a company wrapper to get funding. And I think there could be a little bit more flexibility in the funding approach, where you shouldn't just need to set up a company to get funding. So I think that's something that I'd like to see change. There is a lack still of translational funding and seed funding. There's a bit of a gap there between proof of concept funding and then that gap between $1 million to $5 million of funding. There's a lack of those sorts of investments. You know, it's moved. When I first started out in tech transfer, it used to be, maybe this is giving away my age, but it used to be around the 100 to 500,000 mark was where the funding was lacking. And that's moved up. So now it's the sort of 1 to 5 million investment amount that's lacking. And that really is a gap that our fund bridges.
Is that something that you think universities will have to tackle on their own with a fund such as yours? Or is it something that we should have a UK-wide approach? Or
it's difficult because I think UCLB is privileged in that it's got access to a fund like that. And I think we can only do that because UCL is such a big university and it's a world-leading university. So we have the deal flow that means that you can project the models for the fund and the returns for a fund like that just with what UCL does. I think if you're a smaller university with excellent research, that's more of a challenge. So I'm not really sure what the ideal approach would be because every university and institution is unique. And there have been central funded models used in the past, and they've not always been successful because I think there is a sense of disenfranchisement from universities and institutions where they've each got their own unique culture, and having centralized funding doesn't necessarily work. There have been regional development funds which have helped, but again, you know, they've all had challenges. And I think I think you need a variety of approaches. I don't think there's any one approach that fits all. The big universities, I think, can have their own funds, Oxford, Cambridge, Imperial, UCL, Manchester. I mean, Manchester, actually, that's an interesting model. And I'm sure you'll talk to Andy Wilkinson at Manchester, some of the northern universities, because they have addressed that. And Scotland, too, they've had regional funding, which has helped. The approach that they have taken is they'll group together so that they get that critical mass, which means they can then access funds that with which they can do something that will make a sizable impact. I think you need to have a variety of approaches.
It is quite interesting that you mentioned Cambridge there as well, because when they set up Cambridge Innovation Capital, they very specifically set it up so it can invest in the whole Cambridge ecosystem. It was not specifically spin out. So the fact that UCL has a fund, albeit smaller so far at this point, that's exclusively focused on UCL. I mean, it's saying quite a lot about the activity that's going on for you, but it's quite interesting that you haven't said it can invest throughout London or the Golden Triangle or whatever the boundaries may have been.
Exactly. And I think the thing is with Cambridge, you know, Cambridge has been there for over 1,000 years. They've had all that time to build up a huge ecosystem. And UCL has been there a long time, not 1,000 years, but it's been there a long time. I think you really need 3, 4, 5 different funds to be able to then spread the edges of that fund. At the moment, we want to make sure that we get a successful model that works for UCL and that benefits UCL. When we get to Fund 5 and Fund 6, which I hope we will do, probably long after I've retired, but then possibly we can look at that. We do that with our social enterprise fund. We don't invest in things outside of UCL, but we use that social enterprise fund to make an impact locally and nationally if we can. Because I think that's something that as a commercialization company, we've tended to focus nationally and internationally rather than locally. And having social enterprise funding, you can look at local issues and try and address some of those challenges. I can foresee a time when our fund will stretch beyond those boundaries. But at the moment, I think we need to make sure that the model is successful for UCL. And then once we've built that platform, then we can develop it further.
That makes sense. A lot to look forward to still. And I mean, at this speed, you might see Fund 4 or 5 still.
I think the fact that we managed to have the first close for the second fund right in the middle of the pandemic.
Yes.
Is, you know, that was an achievement. And I think that's testament to both the support we got from UCL and to the quality of UCL's research. You can overestimate that. Hopefully we'll reach our target £100 million fund. And start thinking about Fund 3.
Amazing. Just one more question. Well, it's an open-ended question, whether there's anything that we haven't covered. And I know there's a lot of things we haven't covered, but was there anything specific that you still wanted people to know about?
No, I, don't think so. I mean, I think I've talked about all the things I wanted to talk about. Social enterprise is definitely one of my favourites. I think UCL, I'm very proud to work there. I like the approach that UCL takes. I think the only thing I probably would mention is that since, and as you mentioned at the beginning, I've been at UCL a long time. So I've seen a lot of the changes. And what I would say is that the innovation and enterprise culture at UCL has developed significantly in the last 10 years. And that has really made a difference to what we do. And people are much more aware of what we do. They know what we do. And people think and as I said, not just in a financial impact way, they look at what their world approach is. And that is part of UCL's culture. So that's the other thing I'd like to say, is that having that background and that platform really to work from has made a huge difference to us. And really, I think, allowed us to do what we've done and had the success that we've had over the last 5 years.
That seems to be the case, everyone I've spoken to so far anyway. Over the last 10 years or so, the awareness of the existence of commercialization offices within universities has certainly risen by a noticeable percentage. As I said before, we only track spin-outs, but even there, the numbers have been going up globally since we started looking at them, since 2012.
Yeah, I definitely would agree. I think the fact that you have organisations like Autumn and like Praxis RL, where there is a real career path, very strong career path. It is an industry now. I think it has become a lot more sophisticated in the last 10 years too. And I think our approach has really changed from certainly when I started out 20 years ago to where we are now. And the fact that we do value our projects, I mean, that gives you much greater negotiating power so that you can really realise value for the university. That was something we wouldn't have even been able to do 20 years ago. One, we didn't have the resource to do it, but also a way of looking at very early stage research can be quite challenging, because if you use the usual valuation methods, it can sometimes come back with a negative value because it's so high risk. But I think we've moved beyond that.
That's long may it continue.
I think so. And I think the fact that all the commercialization groups and universities that I work with are so willing to share their resources, their experiences, what works, what doesn't work, being able to do that on an international platform really, really does help inform how you do things and mean that you can constantly improve. So those sorts of organizations, you know, TenU, Praxis RL, Autumn, ASTP, I'm sure I haven't covered all of them, but they really do help. The other thing they do is make the industry more accessible to people starting out, because it wasn't a job that you would necessarily have thought about when you were an undergraduate, or even when I was doing my PhD, I didn't even know about it. Whereas now I get a lot more inquiries from people who want to get into what we do. That's very encouraging to see.
Do you, just maybe one last question on that, do you have any kind of programs where you have PhDs or postdocs do fellowships within the office or training programs?
So I don't know if any of the other people that you've interviewed talked about the LifeArc fellowships. So
no, not yet.
So the LifeArc fellowships is an interesting program. It's very similar to the American PhD rotation program, where you work in three or four different labs and then you pick the one you're going to stay with. And that is to train people in commercialization of research. It was funded by LifeArc. And it works with London universities. So people will do rotations around the commercialization offices of a number of London universities. So we do that. We do internships. We don't have a formal system for that. And generally speaking, those are directed at UCL, graduates, students and graduates. It can take a lot of resource to do internships, but certainly we will, you know, we have a lot of people do work shadowing. And there may be a possibility that we do that with some of the other organisations that I work with. But we do try and do that. And I will always try and make time, if I can, to talk to someone who wants to find out about getting into tech transfer or commercialisation. I'm always very happy to do that.
That's wonderful. I think we are coming up on the end of our podcast. Thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day, despite the workmen in the background as well.
I apologise for that. I know I had someone cleaning the window just now with the hose eyes.
No, it's fine. And I appreciate you still joining us on the podcast. It's been a real pleasure and very insightful. Thank you very much, Anne.
I hope so. I hope it's given you some food for thought. And thank you very much for asking me to do it. It's been a pleasure.
Talking Tech Transfer is hosted by me, Thierry Helis. It is produced by Global University Venturing, a Morsonia Limited publication. You can find us at globaluniversityventuring.com, on LinkedIn as Global University Venturing, or on Twitter at GU Venturing. Our sound engineer is Mark Chatterley from In Ear Production. You can find them on inearproduction.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, make sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an interview. We'd also really love it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or if you share this podcast with your friends and colleagues. It really helps us grow our audience. You can also reach out to me directly with feedback. Just email thehelis@globaluniversityventuring.com. That is thelis@globaluniversityventuring.com. Until next time, have a great week, everyone. Goodbye.